This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest is Stanley Plumley, and here he is with a poem.
Wrong side of the river. I watched you on the wrong side of the river, waving. You were trying to tell me something. You used both hands and sort of ran back and forth, as if to say, look behind you, look out behind you. I wanted to wave back. But you began shouting, and I didn't want you to think I understood. So I did nothing but stand still, thinking that's what to do on the wrong side of the river. After a while, you did too. We stood like that for a long time. Then I raised a hand as if to be called on, and you raised a hand as if to the same question.
The voice of Stanley Plumley. We have invited him here because he teaches us the spiritual possibilities of what the poem can be. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the library. I want to celebrate Stanley's new book, Argument and Song. And the subtitle is Sources and Silences in Poetry. Very significant subtext. And this just came out. It's coming out in paperback, right?
Soon.
How do you describe accreting these essays throughout the years from what? Was the first one 75 or?
About 75, maybe 72. I'd have to look at the dates on them. But it's been more than 30 years.
And you accumulated these essays and delivered them, I'm sure, and published them variously. What is it then, when they come together, what do they make for you, Stanley? What do you characterize this?
Well, it's a way, I suppose, for me to test my consistency. I hope not a foolish consistency, as Emerson said, but one in which a voice and thoughtfulness about poetry is established and followed through.
And I want you to know that if anyone wants the deepest relaxation of the soul, just take that book away for a weekend. I took it to Ocean City. I never saw the ocean. Stanley, it's not fair. I just read that book. It is a vacation. It is Stanley Plumley at his most meditative art in prose. I must say also that one page of it is so lyrical that it appeared in a book of poems.
Right, I used it as a prose poem.
Because each page is a poem.
I guess I couldn't resist self-indulgence. But it's about poetry, but there are other kinds of pieces in it. There are a couple of nature pieces.
I don't think anyone knows more about birds than you do.
There's even a short essay on Whistler, on his nocturnes, something that's always interested me.
And as always, honoring John Keats.
Absolutely. He's a kind of, not a light, but a rather heavy motif running through it, yes.
Mm-hmm. In fact, you walked the walk. Tell us about where you went in England.
I've been working on other kinds of prose about Keats for many years, but he pops up in this selection of essays as well. So I've lived in various parts of England, sort of following his trail, and in fact spent a year at the Keats House doing research, something you couldn't do now because they've moved all the archives to a different part of London. But I practically lived in that house for a year, spent some time at the Keats House, the so-called Keats and Shelley House in Rome, but also followed him around the island. And one of the most interesting parts of that journey was the trail that he followed, the walk he took every day.
The woods.
At the very end of his life in Winchester, before he wrote To Autumn.
And you will be writing more about him. It is a biography?
No, it's got biographical material in it. It's another kind of meditation, I suppose. It's really a meditation on immortality. how it works, and in a way how mortal immortality is, and how accidental, really.
I like what Robert Pinsky says about the book. He honors John Keats with the informed intimacy of actual practice. These essays reveal the mysterious drama of great poetry and its makers as supremely useful. He goes on, but my point is that this book should be in every college classroom and maybe can be.
Well, wouldn't just that
came
be
out.
Great?
Just came out this year, so we'll see.
Yeah.
It is put out by what publisher?
Other Press. Mm-hmm. Hansel Books is their literary component, and they've really got into the literary business in the last 5 years.
And
they've,
good for them.
They've done a wonderful job with all their books.
Did we say it's going to be paperback?
Yes.
It's going to be paperback.
Within the next year, certainly. Yeah.
So Stanley Plumlee is here. We are at the Library of Congress. We wish to honor his work, which has informed the world. He is one of the nation's very top poets, and it is the greatest pleasure that we hear his next poem.
This is a poem called Naps. Naps. In a dream or fantasy, I see my mother having put me down, leaning over me, pulling the door shut twice, and if I rise again, locking it. In school, we were told to put our heads down on the desks and think of it as prayer, or to lie on our left sides on the floor, an inch between the pound weight of the heart and passage of the earth. We were told to listen to the silence, not to talk, and breathe in slowly, slowly, and pretend if we had to, it was dark. Already on our own, we'd learned to study out the window, to cogitate the tree within the cloud, the long sunlit fingers of the crow, and how to hold an object in the mind and let it turn until it turned the other life it wanted, the way a doorknob with its facet gaze of glass becomes a diamond or a crystal. And as you fall asleep, disintegrates, snow in a paperweight. And now we were intuiting, sleeping in the future, the disconnected nights, the dawn light wakings, the shadow puzzles clouding up the windows, the hardwood study table and a chair, gravity's floor, a lifetime's worth of all the afternoons we'd lose or lose part of, trying to recover what was lost. So we'd use our hands and arms to blind the eyes, and then the mind to separate ourselves, then wait the voice outside calling our return, the same voice as the moment of instruction, to lie down in the middle of the day, dream fragmentary, dusk enhancing dreams, be the body of the one looked upon, come back to life, O startled, distant child.
Stanley Plumlee, I'm Grace Cavalieri. How do you get there? How do you get there?
Well, I think the oldest and the sagest advice is always practice, practice, practice. I think you have to hear the poem for a long, long time in your head and on the page to make sure it has arrived
place,
where you want it to be.
The place where it starts is what I'm talking about. I know that you practice yoga.
Yes.
Okay, you said for 7 years.
Well, now about 10 years, yeah.
But
yeah.
Even your work before then had
yes,
this meditative
well,
quality.
Well, that's part of my Quaker heritage. I started doing that a long, long time ago.
Right,
even
science.
When I didn't want to do it, you were sort of forced into it, sitting on those hard benches for a couple of hours.
But the silence that you capture and the light and the shadows and the dark and the... I read you when I need to, and I think everyone should also. Haunting work, I think the highest kind of lyricism being written in today's poetry. Does anyone tell you that?
I've heard that before. Yes, thank you.
Let's hear another.
This is a poem called Mercy. Some in the audience may recognize a line in the poem that I've borrowed from Emily Dickinson. A murder of crows. What I saw on a spindle of dead white oak, two or three of them at different times hectoring the head of the sick one, the old one, the weak one apart. From school, those Eskimo stories in which leathery grandfathers and grandmothers are left behind or set afloat. They'd freeze, Mr. Steinman said, from the extremities in. Thinking about what they must have been thinking, I imagined the brain last on the ascending list, as freezing persons recollect the snow, I read in chilling poetry years later. Even at 12, the concept seemed distant, efficient. In keeping with the clarity and killing cold of vast, undifferentiated Arctic spaces. In keeping with the landscape of the old. In the language of the desert Navajo, the old man didn't drown, the water came up to get him. Mm-hmm. That's how I imagined freezing, as a kind of incremental drowning, a sort of slow word-by-word submersion. Then at last the pulling under rings on water. The killed crow fell the 60 feet in seconds, less, though in the while it took to find it, it had moved. My mother, alive in the machine, becalmed on hard white sheets, the narrative of legs, arms, animal centers stilled, some starlight in the mind glittering off and on, couldn't tell me whether or not to leave her.
Stanley Plumlee at the Library of Congress, if you were to think about how it is that you can get so close to the reader, can you put your finger on what that is in your work?
Well, I don't know. That's
you really get next to the reader.
Yeah, I guess because one at some point in the career of the poem has to become that reader, at least one's own ideal reader, and it's an odd paradox. You have to be separated from the work and yet love what you do at the same time. You're almost in a kind of schizophrenia about yourself.
But there is an intimacy about your work that I yes. think is what makes us draw
absolutely.
In so close.
Absolutely. But the separation is part of that intimacy.
Mm. I don't know anyone else attempting this as much as W.S. Merwin and maybe Mark Strand. Do you think
those are two poets I admire a great
well,
deal?
Well, you are the three. So let's hear another poem. We're at the Library of Congress. He is Stanley Plumlee.
A great American subject, this one, I think, debt. When I refer to three great high modernist poets here who knew something about money in different kinds of ways. Debt. Pound, for whom collateral was metaphor. Stevens, for whom poetry was a kind of money. Eliot, who counted money in a bank. Oh, let them be the three or four doer men standing around the outside of the house, funereally in overcoats, stamping their feet, staring or looking down, faintly breathing fire. It's a hard Ohio morning, snowing. My father's out there, too, in shirt sleeves, hands in his pockets, two or three tired years past 30. Then one of the men is writing in a book that makes me think of school. The other's drawing pictures in the air, which is the still gray, grainy white of paper. What else? Except they measure off the fence rows walk the acre frontage, wade a sort of circle of the house, as if they're going to buy it. What else except the window ice and cold and whole enough to see through? Secrecy, fell silence, and the intermittent, fragmentary snow, fields of it, and half a mile or less, the B&O. Pound defined usury as the tax on borrowed time by those who own mortality. I wish Pound had been there. I wish someone like him. He had the moment's right mad temperament and the animal face of the prophet. Wallace Stevens as well, in that gray wool worsted coat he wore on his wintry walks to work, the W's like angels in the snow. The greatest poverty, he said, is not to live within a physical world. Great poverty is what it felt like when they stood like winter itself in the middle of the room talking figures. I was 9 or 10 and 20 years from poetry when Eliot said, imagination is different from fulfillment.
A Doctrine of Signatures is the title of this book in which that poem is found. And who else would put those three guys together anyway around money with the recurring theme, the Exalted Father? The Exalted Father comes in there again. That is your signature, isn't it?
Well, he is, yeah, he is both personal and archetypal, I think. And again, that double life. Yeah.
I agree. And there also, this is a very good poem to know your work because it is without judgment. I guess, I think your life might be a good point, Grace.
Yeah. You're right. I don't think about that, but that's the result.
In fact, I was looking again at your work, and I just saw my note, no judgment. Yeah. And that may be about the way you live your life, too. I'm not sure. But you can speak of the terror of voices in some memories that are not pretty, but you never judge.
Quakers have a word for that. It's called giving witness. And I think you're absolutely correct in the sense that the moment you begin to judge, you cut off certain possibilities, certain options, and you really begin to close down the imaginative part of your thinking.
Why can't we learn that first rather than last?
Well, it is something you do learn.
Yeah. Stanley Plumley, I'm Grace Cavalieri. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress.
This is a poem called Simile. This heart I found at low tide this morning, accurate to a fault, hand-sized, heart-shaped, with the thick weight of a heart, a perfect piece of limestone cut by hand by the sea who knows how long, brought up from the bottom again and again, split like our own hearts, nicked from the top half down. As if in another life it had been real, stone atrium, stone sorrow, stone ventricles, stone arteries and veins. And these glittering halves of oyster shells I picked this afternoon, like the stones worn into shape, swirled, half-eaten out, still oiled and pearly wet, with edges sharp enough to clean a fish. Imagine that the oysters have survived, like eyes of the otherworldly, or symbols of some sexual potency, lookalikes for testicles, or a woman's soft insides, as we drink them down by swallowing them whole. In the doctrine of signatures, things become themselves as something else, as we are who we are, word of mouth. Then I found a bird, a kind of gull, eaten by the fish and other birds, one missing wing, one eye, the rest of it so rendered past resemblance, you throw it back into the void, the chaos it came from, yet the moment it goes under, it's a memory, a metaphor, we say, for what we can't quite name. Tip of the tongue, whistle in the bone, death and its variety, its part by piece, detail. Like the skull washed up, one lost and found new year, fallen from the ocean sky, dead off the moon, something to conjure with, now set on the desk on the bony back of its head, neither human nor animal, but brilliant white brain coral, pitted, scalloped, furrowed at the brow, its stone teardrop-shaped face a mask for mourning. Unlike the shapely clouds, changeable, emotional, a skein of moving mare's tails, a skimmer's broken wing, cumulonimbus palaces, where once and future beings act out their human longing. I went down to the sea, the source of life. It was filled to overflowing. The blue horizon line, however many miles, parted nothing more than air from bluer water, though it was poetry to say what it looked like.
Is that the title poem?
I guess it is.
A Doctrine of Signatures?
I didn't mean for it to be,
but
it turned out to be. You know, this is typical of me. All those objects exist. I have them in my office. They're real objects. I could not write a poem like this unless I had the real thing in front of me. And that's just how my imagination works.
The oyster shells.
The oyster shells. But mostly I have this marvelous piece of limestone, perfect heart shape, with this crack right down the middle to about three quarters. I have this skull-shaped brain coral, too, that's the size of a head, human head, which I found
so
in Florida.
So your image vocabulary is from objects.
Oh, absolutely.
And,
but from real objects and things that entered my life involuntarily. Absolutely.
But then there's always the Stanley Plumley question, the original. We are what we are by word of mouth.
Yeah.
Is that the way we are?
I think
is that
are.
How we get put together?
Yeah, exactly. You can go take that all the way back to the Book of Genesis, the breath.
But what a way to put it. Stanley Plumley, I'm Grace Cavalieri. They say many things about him. They say he is a modern elegiac poet, successor to James Wright and John Keats, with a marvelous ear for the music of contemplation. Rita Dove said that. He's been honored with the Delmore Schwartz Memorial Award, nominations for the National Book Critics Circle Award, the William Carlos Williams Award, and the Academy of American Poets Lenore Marshall Poetry Prize. He is a distinguished university professor and professor of English at the University of Maryland. And those are your credentials, whether you recognize them or not. That's what we got by word of mouth. So let's go on.
Here's a poem that is, you might say, very local. Farragut North, which is a metro stop, among other things, here in Washington. In the tunnel light at the top of the station, two or three figures, huddled under tarps, built against the wind, crossing Connecticut at Kay. It'll be noon before they rise in their Navajo blankets, trinkets, ski masks, and gloves to start the day. Noon before the oil slicks of ice on the sidewalks thaw. In the 40s, after the war in the land of Uz, when somebody came to the house for a handout, my mother'd give him milk money or bread money, as well as bread and milk. To her, each day was the 30s. The men at the door had the hard-boiled faces of veterans, soldiers of the enemy. My mother saw something in them, homelessness, the condition of some happiness, as if in the faces of these drifters could be read pieces of parts of herself still missing. Like the Indian woman in Whitman's Sleepers, who comes to his mother's door looking for work when there is no work, yet is set by the fire and fed, so that for my mother, the first time she left, it became a question of whom to identify with most, the wanderer or the welcomer. The stunted sycamores on K are terminal, though they'll outlast the hairline fractures marbling the gravestones of the buildings. Under the perfect pavement of the sky, the figures frozen in this landscape contemplate the verities too fundamentally for city or country. Their isolation is complete, like the dead or gods. When I think of a day with nothing in it, a string of such days, I think of the gray life of buildings, of walking out of my life in a direction just invented, or since some of us survive within the mental wards of our own third worlds, I see myself disguised for constant winter, withdrawn into the inability to act on the least impulse save anger, and hear myself in street talk talking street time. Such is the freedom of transformation, letting the deep voice climb on its own. Such is the shell of the body broken, falling away like money's new clothes. Such is my mother's truant spirit, moving dead leaves with the wind among shadows.
Truant spirit. Such is, those devices that get you where you need to go, as in the Pound poem. What else, you said, what else? Do you realize, are you aware when you're doing that, how you get us from one place to another?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you are aware.
So we get the language of your experience. We have incidents of your life. But then in each poem, they come together in a moment. There's always a moment in your poem where it all comes together. This time it's your mother giving out something to the hobos of the 40s. And then the poem fans out again to more universal meanings. But your experience does come together. Do you feel that in each poem?
Well, I think, of course, that's its part of its root system. I feel very committed to what I say to my students is the interrupted narrative. Narrative can be pretty boring when it's merely recited and repeated experience, so to speak, or a repeated version of experience, because there are no straight lines in nature, and there aren't, I think, in true organic writing. So I describe it as a meander, which is a natural movement, the way a river moves or a snake moves or whatever. It's what generates the energy. In a way, the diversion is part of the most interesting aspect of the writing.
And when you're teaching John Keats, and I know you have a graduate class waiting for you actually to go back, and you say comfort them because they are doing studying Keats's odes.
Exactly. They're in the process of writing final papers right now.
Right this
minute. We spent the semester surrounding the odes with, I hope, relevant information, and then examining them ode by ode, really line by line, over the course of the term.
And are you hoping that they'll bring something to that which is new?
Yeah, I want them to write, not research papers, they know that, something fairly original, which will be supported by evidence, of course. But
can you be surprised by someone saying something you hadn't thought of?
Oh, sure. I hope so.
And it happens?
Yeah, we do that in class all the time. When I ask a question in class, it's usually because I want an answer. I'm not certain myself.
Do you have a lot of hope about these young people?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm.
Are they PhDs or MAs?
Some are, graduates? Some MAs, some PhDs, some mm-hmm. MFAs.
Yeah, yes. We're talking at the University of Maryland at College Park. Thank you. the Library of Congress with Stanley Plumley. I'm Grace Cavalieri. He is reading from two books, one of his collected poems, Now That My Father Lies Down Beside Me, and that's HarperCollins Echo.
Right.
And then the new manuscript, which is A Doctrine of Signatures, which is a premiere, and that is always, I think we're the first people ever to hear that. Not even publicly?
A couple of those poems, yes, I haven't read.
You haven't given a reading?
No,
of those.
Maybe once, but I can't remember, actually.
And so now we're going back to your collected poems.
Yes. This is a poem from the past that I've always had a lot of affection for because of the event in the poem was a wonderful time in my life. I was asked to do something I thought was going to be very strange, which was to go to Wyoming. This was when the NEA was more able to be generous with areas of this great country that didn't receive a lot of attention from the arts. And so one of the things the Wyoming Arts Council did was to sponsor this, what they called poetry circuit. And as I recall, there's one university in Wyoming and two junior colleges. That it may have changed since this time, but the rest of the time I was reading in hunting lodges and bars. It's called the Wyoming Poetry Circuit. Climbing down out of the rain. Let me say, I didn't know how to start this poem, and I tried for many years. So I divert the reader first off in order to get to Wyoming. Climbing down out of the rain, which is what the breakable upper branches were, rain, webbed, hardly visible vessels, the imprint of the leaves long since Cambrian, Ordovician, rooted out of time, the cold, breakable rain branching out of sight, but thicker the lower down you went, thickest at the trunk. My father had put me up there to look for deer above the scent. I never got it right. It all looked rain to me, the star points at a distance blurring with the trees. Two other moments, one with friends in a great field in the spring, the cold sky filled or emptied out of wind, the Stella's jays angry or friendly depending. Then suddenly a redwing flies into my hand, just long enough to take the bread. I can see the spots like a starling's, and the clipped blood reds lit within the wing. It is amazing, a moment and nothing. And the other, above the wind river basin, in moon country, along the skyline, the loose trail of antelope, drifting with the herds, heraldic, half-wild, following the traffic down to better pasture, dead meat and following to slaughter. We have to stop the truck to let them pass. They congregate in front of us like cages. Light, then dusk, passes through them. Wyoming is dusk all day. I remember it seemed deeper in the air, layers of the intertonguing rock, permeable, passable, like rain, like a storm in daylight passing to the north, the Indian towns starving with the dark, the ranches poor with oil or coal or the animal debt of the land, which had a shine like dry seabeds or maria, silver, though they held their shadow. In Sheridan we met in a hunting lodge to talk, no one from anywhere you could name, who loved the place or got stuck. We talked into the night, the still walls lined with signs and wonders. Love will never let us alone, which is exactly what it does. That night it got too late. Even outside in moonlight we could see our faces, people you'd never see again who'd traveled hundreds of miles in a landscape through stone just to talk or hear the poem read against silence. The next morning was winter, the rain ice cold, October. but by afternoon, clear with the smell of snow. All those towns to get through, all that endless, gradual ground. At Wind River, the walls were stratified like ladder variations on the color stone, a ladder to be dreamed of climbing from the earth. We stopped to watch the river move its tons of trainloads of the rock. My friend said that stone is what they have instead of trees, which are immortal, flowering out of stone like souls in secret. I could believe it, counting the outcrop few leading toward the horizon. The small stone in the hand, she said, is for loneliness, company, good luck. To the south, past Rollins, there were elk, like shale and mud and blue dusk, part of a cut that had climbed out of the river. Animals, part tree, part stone, coming down, she said, to feed with the herds, to take a look at us, but not too close, or not at all.
From the book Now That My Father Lies Down Beside Me, collected poems by Stanley Plumley. When I think of that poem and I remember it, what I remember first is being on the hunting lookout with your father.
Mm.
Because that's the point of departure.
Right.
And now you tell me that that was a way of getting into the poem.
Yeah, when I was trying to first do the poem, it took me several years. It kept turning into a travelogue. That is to say, the narrative kept winning. And, first this, first that, one, two, three, four, five. It was all sequence and no consequence. And so I thought, well, what if I start inside the experience with a motif, the rain or the rock
and
or
the
whatever.
Wet and the bird, the red
and
wing.
Then,
your
of
head.
Course, that took place at a great, what was the name of that, state park in California. I was just tossing the bread into the air and the jays would pick them up. And I was about to do that one more time when this red-winged blackbird, which is the most beautiful American bird, flew into my hand and took that bread. As I say, if the thing hasn't happened, I can't deal with it.
Uh-huh.
I say to my students that metaphor is not something you make up, it's something you make from. And at least that's how I've had to work.
This is Stanley Plumley speaking. You are also a great naturalist.
Well, I don't know about that, but I love the natural world in a way that I can understand it. Yeah.
And you have such patience with it.
Well, you don't have much choice. You have to.
You can walk away from it.
Well, you could, but if you're going to enjoy it, you have to sit in it, you have to walk in it, you have to be in it, and you have to be in time with it. In sync with it, I think, is the way.
And that's what
it.
I like about the essays so much, argument and song, because you take us into the woods with you and describe every flora and fauna and bird and tree, and you knew so much or you learned so much?
Well, both. I mean, you see and then you have to figure out what it is you're seeing. That's a kind of reflective act. But cities, too, are nature. They may be artifice and they may be man-made, but they have their own natural aspect, or we turn them into nature. We have a need to do that, and we'll, hence in New York, those avenues, those great avenues become canyons. The way the wind works on those streets, sometime walking along in a place like New York, there'll be stillness, and you cross the street, go around the corner, and you'll be hit with this incredible force of wind coming off the park or, who knows, off the Hudson, whatever. Well, that's nature. And you look up, and those buildings have divided the sky in a certain way that forces you to focus on a segment of sky you wouldn't notice somewhere else, certainly way out in the world, in Montana or somewhere, Wyoming. And so you'll notice the shape of a cloud that you might not have been interested in.
I'm glad you don't paint, or we wouldn't get any poetry.
Well, that's how actually I started out.
Did you
really?
A
lousy painter, yeah. That was my first job teaching painting.
You and Mark Strand.
Well, I fell into it. I think he had plans. I had no plans.
You know how to see.
So that's one thing that taking painting classes does teach you. It teaches you what to look for.
Stanley Plumley, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're going to go on.
This is a poem in a different direction, Infidelity. The two-toned olds swinging sideways out of the drive, the bone-white gravel kicked up in a shot, my mother in the death seat, half out the door half shut. She's being pushed or wants to jump, I don't remember. The olds is two kinds of green, hand-painted, and blows black smoke like a coal oil fire. I'm stunned and feel a wind like a machine pass through me, through my heart and mouth. I'm standing in a field, not 50 feet away, the wheel of the wind closing the distance. Then suddenly the car stops and my mother falls with nothing, nothing to break the fall. One of those moments we give too much to.
Mm.
Like the moment of acknowledgement of betrayal, when the one who's faithless has nothing more to say, and the silence is terrifying, since you must choose between one or the other emptiness. I know my mother's face was covered black with blood, and that when she rose, she too said nothing. Language is a darkness pulled out of us. But I screamed that day she was almost killed, whether I wept or ran or threw a stone or stood stone still, choosing at last between parents, one of whom was driving away.
What a tough poem. That's one of the few where you get the narrative and the complication, and then there's actually closure in that. That it doesn't happen all the time. But actually, there isn't closure either. No, there isn't. I take that
back. There are different times being elevated and juxtaposed there. Yeah, different times in one's life. Yeah.
But you know, always, as I said, the lack of judgment and the sweet grief. There's a grief underlying all those words, but it's not, it's sweet. You turn it into something. How do you turn grief into something?
I don't know if I'd use the word sweet, but it is, I'd like to think there's a forgiveness there, an implicit forgiveness.
Oh, there is.
I guess another fancier word there would be reconciliation.
A complaint in any of your work.
And I think that's how memory works. It ought to teach you forgiveness.
Your memory, maybe.
And
well, Gandhi said it, didn't he?
Well, I don't know. I don't think we have to be quite so
grandiose,
but a being. But
to change your work.
To me, it's the only way that happiness works. It's not to subtract the sadness in your life. It's to add something else to it simultaneously.
What's in the line.
I think part of the judgment you're talking about is some people feel they always have to make a choice. You don't have to. The soul, or whatever you want to call it, is capacious and can include a great deal, I think, even opposition.
To change your poetry, change yourself first. This is Stanley Plumley reading to us from his book.
When I would go to visit my mother back in Ohio, she would always report to me on the status of my former classmates from elementary school, high school, and whatnot. It was not something I necessarily wanted to hear about. And it was amazing to me after a while, as the evidence began to pile up, how unfortunate that little group I started out with at Spring Creek Township School on the western side of Ohio, there were about 20 of us, I suppose, what percentage of those people ended up not doing well? I thought the percentage was a little outsized. And when I began to put it together, I came up with this poem. souls of suicides as birds. Because of his fierce red-orange hair, which he hated and threatened to dye, and did on more than one occasion, leaving the half-look of his head strangely mottled, as if he had survived scarlet fever, which in his embarrassment he sometimes claimed he had. And because he spoke and acted with a certain insect abruptness, yet showiness, in spite of his childish size, more diminutive each year. And because Timothy is a grass, Tim the diminution, he's become an American redstart, demonstrative at the tip-top of branches. Chewee, chewee, chewee. Linda Manus, whose intelligent high-wire crisis voice piqued everyone's angst, even at 12, is a chipping sparrow, heard as well in the backyard as among the orchard cages. She took poison, then a razor, then ran. Timothy Cottrell used all 20 gauges of his gun. The farmer Elifritz drove his tractor through a worn-out wall of his barn, thereby piercing his throat with old wood, and therefore is a warbler. Black-throated blue, who loves the swampy interior, the dense scrub undergrowth. Jack Butts, whose Vietnam wound was total like a lightning scar, lived for as long as is possible in Piqua, Ohio, and be alive. And Jerry Hart, star athlete, died of AIDS. One is a purple, one a boat-tailed grackle. And when Raymond Baker flew with his Ford Fairlane through the barrels and signs of detour, planing his head through the windshield, he became a swift, able to dive down chimneys and vector a straight line of the invisible air like an arrow aimed at silence. And the two sisters, Alma and Kay, each impregnated by their father, transpired for a while as whippoorwills, then doves, but found real joy as thrushes, hermetic, unadorned, but adored at evening. Kay found Alma hanging and followed. These friends from school, and there are more doubtless I don't know about, and others almost subtle who crafted deaths too natural, none of whom made it out of their 30s or 40s, none of them murdered, none of them victims of street fire or planes, sticks and stones or drugs, none of them missing persons, all of them starlings, or the siren noise high in the tulip poplars.
How in the world did you ever transform them?
Well, I started with I remembered the old concept of the bird as a symbol for the soul, going back to ancient times. And it just struck me that, why not now? Why can't those birds be representatives now?
And why, indeed they are.
Of ancient souls. And so,
when you were in England so much, and you do write about birds very much there, is there any bird there that is not here that you can think of? I mean, first of all...
Oh, I'm sure there are lots. I mean, I prefer the passerine kind, as to say the songbirds and the, you know, the small, more insignificant types. You notice that no state claims a sparrow as its state bird. No state claims a crow or even a blue jay, which are cousins to crows because of their personalities and whatnot.
In Italy, you hear the nightingale, but do you hear it? Can you hear it in America?
Yeah, what we call our nightingale is a good old democratic grave ground brown bird that Whitman labels in his great elegy for Lincoln. The hermetic thrush, or the hermit
thrush. Oh, the thrush is the nightingale?
Yeah. And, of course, their music is in direct proportion to the beauty of their music is in direct proportion to the plainness of their being. I think of the American birds, the cardinal is the exception. It has a pretty great singing voice in the evening, especially. It chirps in the morning. The cardinal, which is the most popular state bird, even has a name town in Iowa named for its early morning call, and that is "What cheer, what cheer, what cheer," and the town is called What Cheer. I think there's even an exclamation
point
after.
Was someone really that imaginative?
If you're driving along Route 80, you'll see a sign, one of those green, white, and green signs.
I give Ohio more credit than I thought.
It's amazing.
Stanley Plumlee. We are at the Library of Congress. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we are going to go forward.
Again, let's shift gears a bit. We've been talking about Keats, referring to Keats. I have several poems that come out of moments of my response to his life. Little things that I think were unnoticed. This is a sort of, this poem, though, is a fantasy. Keats and John Constable lived in Hampstead at the same time. There's no record of them having ever met. In fact, the summer after Keats writes the odes, or is revising the odes, the spring odes, Constable is in Hampstead having trouble with his career painting the sky. He's painting nothing but the sky. Actually, he's painting clouds. Constable's Clouds for Keats. They come in off the sea, peaceable masters, and hold the sea and the sky as long as they can. And you write them down in oils, because of their brilliance, and to remember in its turn each one. It's 1822 after the Regency, and it would be right in the year after his death to think of these, domed above the heath in their isolated chronicle, as elegies of the spirit, right to see these forms as melancholy hosts, even at this distance. Yet dead Keats is amorphous, a shapelessness reforming in the ground, and no one you know enough to remember. He lies in the artist's paradise in Rome, among the pagan souls of sheep at pasture. You'll lie in Hampstead where he should have stayed, to meet you on your walks up Lower Terrace or along the crowning High Street heading home. Your clouds grow whiter, darker, more abstract from one elaborate study to the next. Correlatives are close to the real sentiment that lives, you say, in clouds. Subjects to counterweigh the airy gravity of trees and leaping horses. Keats could have met you. You must have seen him once against the light, at least. He could be crossing on Christchurch Hill Road now, then over to the Elm Row and down Old Admiral's Walk. He could be looking at the clouds blooming between buildings, watching the phantoms levitating stone. He was there your first heath summer, writing odes, feeling the weather change from warm to chill, focused no less than you on daylight's last detail, wondering what our feelings are without us.
And we will have a final poem.
Okay. Birthday. An old mortality. These evening doorways into rooms, this door from the kitchen, and there's the yard. The grass not cut and filled with sweetness, and in the thorn the summer wounding of the sun, and locked in the shade the dove calling down. The glare's a little blinding still, but only for the moment of surprise, like suddenly coming into a hall with a window at the end, the light stacked up like scaffolding. I am that boy again my father told not to look at the ground so much. looking at the ground. I am the animal touched on the forehead, charmed. In the sky, the silver maple, like rain in a cloud weave tide. And I see myself walking from what looks like a classroom, the floor waxed white, into my father's arms, who lifts me like a discovery out of this life.
The voice of Stanley Plumlee. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media. Post-production is by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. The series is brought to you by the Humanities Council of Washington, D.C. and the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry. You can hear this series on www.loc.gov/poetry. We wish to thank the Motion Picture, Broadcasting, and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. Additional funding was provided by the National Endowment for the Arts because a great nation deserves great art. Our engineer is Bill Haley. I'm Grace Cavalieri.